Jesus is better than my money. Jesus is better than my plans, my career. Jesus is better than popularity, fame, and money. Jesus is better than... Jesus is better than... Jesus is better.
Well, good morning and welcome. I'm excited to be here today to share with you. Hope that you had a great time celebrating with friends and family our Independence Day. It makes me think of what our second president, John Adams, said when he was reflecting upon what this day meant. He said, "This day of July 1776 will be the most memorable epoch in the history of America. I'm apt to believe that it will be celebrated by succeeding generations as the great anniversary festival. It ought to be commemorated as the day of deliverance by solemn acts of devotion to God Almighty. It ought to be solemnized with pomp and parade, with shows, games, sports, guns, bells, bonfires, and illuminations from one end of this continent to the other, from this time forward, forevermore." So hopefully your 4th of July celebrations looked a little like that. Maybe not exactly like that, but hopefully there was some of it in there. I had a great time celebrating with my family. We're going to start off this morning by just looking at our country's history a little bit, looking about the time when we declared independence and when we began to separate ourselves from the British crown. I've got some pictures that I want to share with you, and we're going to start off by looking at this one, a famous picture of General George Washington leading troops across the Delaware River. Here's what's significant about this picture. This picture was taken on December 20, not obviously the picture wasn't taken then, but this event took place on December 25th, 1776. On Christmas Day, 1776, General George Washington led a small band of 2,400 troops across the Delaware River. You might be asking yourself at this point, why were there only 2,400 troops? Well, let's see. The country was young, it was small, and to be frank, of all of the people who were eligible to support the rebellion, as the crown called it, 60% of the people in the colonies chose to either remain loyal to the crown or to sit on the fence, which left roughly 40% of people to join the Patriots and to see a greater hope, to see the possibility of what America could become. It's not entirely surprising that these loyalists chose not to take up arms with their fellow patriots. When you think about it, they recognize just how powerful the British Army was. At the time, it was considered the most powerful army in the entire world. It was the largest and most powerful Navy fleet. And the number of troops compared to what General Washington would have was much smaller, let alone much greater trained. Our troops from the Patriots represented the Continental Army and local militias. And a lot of these men didn't even have shoes, let alone the necessary equipment to wage a battle against the great redcoats of Great Britain. Somehow, though, some of them chose to follow General Washington. In fact, many of the men that would go across the Delaware with General George Washington were within days of their enlistments ending. But they chose to lead on. Because unlike the loyalists, they weren't asking the question, why can't we just keep things the way they are? Like, isn't this good enough? The loyalists went over that in their mind and they said, let's just leave things alone. Like, why do we want to go against this powerful country of ours? Let's just stay there. Let's just enjoy the benefits of the trade routes they've got, they've set up. And more importantly than anything, let's not die fighting them. Like, they chose that route. Aren't we glad that 2,400 men chose to follow General Washington? After crossing the Delaware River, they landed on the shores of New Jersey. If that wasn't punishment enough being in New Jersey, I grew up in New York, so just to be clear, if that wasn't punishment enough, they came into a very, very harsh conditions. They were outfitted with summer clothes, some without even shoes, like I mentioned before, and they came upon a blizzard. And they had the long, arduous task of marching towards Trenton, New Jersey, where they would surprise, hopefully, the Hessian troops that were supporting the British. It's here that legend has it that on their way to Trenton, they were pushing cannons through the snow, and one of them became lodged. And like every good general, George Washington, from the peak of his horse, just barked down and said, "Hey, you guys get that out of there. Let's go. Like, push that thing out of there." No. What did General Washington do? He hopped off his horse, and he put his shoulder into that side of that cannon, and he nudged it free himself and got it back on board. Thankfully, they were able to surprise the British at Trenton, and they emerged victorious. And this troop emboldened the men. This victory emboldened the men so much so that they continued fighting. They re-enlisted, and then this happened. This is a picture of one of General Washington's closest friends, General Mercer. General Mercer led the vanguard, the crew that went out before the rest of the army in the battle. And it was there that they were overtaken by the British, and mistaking him for George Washington himself, they pleaded with him to surrender. But General Mercer was a patriot. And he said, "Give me liberty or give me death." And he refused to surrender. And he ended up being bayoneted 7 times. He would die 9 days later, 9 agonizing days later. But before he died, something else happened. Once again, General Washington showed the type of man he was. And he got into the mix. He decided to get his hands dirty. And he got off his horse again, and he fought back the men that were surrounding General Mercer. And he was able to bring him to a hospital where he did not die at the hands of the British redcoats, but he died a hero that would inspire the rest of the Revolutionary War. This is a picture of Lord Cornwallis surrendering in September of 1781 after the siege of Yorktown. And lastly, this is a picture of the Treaty of Paris, which was signed in September of 1783, where the British crown yielded the colonies to America and said, "You know what? You can be free. You are a free of an independent country." And it's from there that our country started to form. My questions for you are this. Aren't we glad that the patriots weren't satisfied with how things were? Think about our country today. We should be grateful for the fact that we had men who were willing to take the hard course, that were able to lean into a rough road and fight for what would ultimately become our freedom. And that brings us today to where we are in the book of Hebrews. I know you're trying to think, "Joey, how does this have anything to do with Hebrews?" It does. Because the Hebrews were at a similar juncture that we found our forefathers in 1776. Many of the Hebrews recognized that they were going to be facing insurmountable odds and incomparable hardship as a result of their decision to follow Jesus Christ. They were recognizing that the moment they placed their faith in Jesus Christ, that their spiritual priest became a man who in the Garden of Gethsemane said, "Not by my will, God, but yours," and became obedient to the point of death. They realized that was their leader. And they realized that if they wanted to truly follow him, it wasn't going to be completely easy, that there would be hardship. And so what they started to do is, like the loyalists, they started to say, "You know what? Isn't what we have good enough? Wasn't the old way satisfactory? Like, why can't we just go back to what our father Abraham set up for us so many years ago? Like, Abraham is the patriarch of our faith. He's the father of our faith. He never required this of us. Before, we just had to bring a goat, and they killed the goat. Now you're telling me they might kill me?" And so the author of Hebrews begins an incredible look into why the old way was inferior and the new way with Jesus Christ is superior. And that he does that by introducing a mysterious character named Melchizedek. If you join me in Hebrews chapter 7, I'm going to read. This is what it says. It says in verse 1, "This Melchizedek was king of Salem and priest of God Most High. He met Abraham returning from the defeat of the kings and blessed him. And Abraham gave him a tenth of everything." Before we go further in the book of Hebrews, I want to point out where this actual story comes from. It comes from the book of Genesis. Genesis 14, this is what it says. It says, "Then Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought out bread and wine. He was priest of God Most High, and he blessed Abram, saying, 'Blessed be Abram by God Most High, creator of heaven and earth, and blessed be God Most High, who delivered your enemies into your hand.' Then Abraham gave him a tenth of everything." What the writer of Hebrews has done is he's introduced a character that had obvious significance in the history of their country, in the history of their nation, in the history of their faith. By introducing Melchizedek, he pointed out that there was something before the patriarch, that there was something that even Abraham paid a tithe to, and that even Abraham was blessed by. And that person was Melchizedek. In Hebrews, the writer continues by saying this. He said, "First, his name means king of righteousness. Then also, king of Salem means king of peace. Without father or mother, without genealogy, without beginning of days or end of life, like the Son of God, he remains a priest forever." He says, just think how great he was. Even the patriarch Abraham gave him a tenth of the plunder. Now, the law requires the descendants of Levi who become priests to collect a tenth from the people, that is, their brothers, even though their brothers are descended from Abraham. This man, however, did not trace his descent from Levi, yet he collected a tenth from Abraham and blessed him who had the promises. The author of Hebrews is saying this. He's saying, who was Melchizedek? Well, he doesn't give us a lot of detail specifically of who Melchizedek was. And honestly, there's a lot of competing theories out there. Some people would say that Melchizedek was a theophany or a Christophany, which means an image of the pre-incarnated Christ, that when Abraham met this person, that it was actually Jesus Christ pre-incarnate. I personally don't take that stance, and here's why. It doesn't say that. It says that he was a king and a priest. Another view that people have is that he was some sort of angelic being, that he was an angel that came down, and he had no beginning or end, and then he blessed Abraham and took a tithe. Once again, I have a hard time believing that because it doesn't say that, right? It says that he was a king and a priest. And so my belief is this. My belief is that, it's a big surprise, I believe that Melchizedek was a king and a priest. And Melchizedek was a priest that was a faithful remnant after God dispersed the people of Babel at the Tower of Babel. Remember when he did that, he sent them apart, he changed their languages. A lot of people would just assume that there was no faithful person left on earth. But Melchizedek was there, and we have to believe others were. So I believe that Melchizedek was a priest that was a faithful remnant, and that he was there to show people that God's plan has existed outside of the Abrahamic covenant, that it's existed far beyond that. So I can't give you a definitive answer. My guess is that he's a king and a priest, but I can give you some characteristics about him. Here are some of the characteristics. His name, Melchizedek, actually translates king of righteousness. There's two words, melek and tzedek, which means righteousness. Melek means king, tzedek means righteousness, king of righteousness. I can tell you that he was the king of an actual nation, Salem. And I can tell you that Salem was the ancient city of Jerusalem. And I can tell you that the word Salem, the Hebrew word was shalom, which means peace. So I can tell you that he was a king of peace, a king of righteousness, that he was a priest. I can also tell you that he did not receive his priesthood through genealogy. It says that he was without father and mother. Therefore, his priesthood had to be not because he was born from a specific tribe like the Abrahamic covenant prescribed. He prescribed that you had to be from the tribe of Levi to be a priest, but that Melchizedek was given his priesthood by an oath. And lastly, I can tell you this. I can tell you that Melchizedek was superior to Abraham, and therefore superior to Levi, or the Levites. This is a mind-blowing statement to the Israelites. Because in their world, Abraham was the pinnacle, the genesis of their faith. He was where everything got started. He's the reason they had land, or sometimes not land. He's the reason they had a blessing. He's the reason they had any hope at all. And for the author of Hebrews to introduce a person in the Bible that had four verses spoken about them in Genesis and say, this man was greater than Melchizedek, would have taken them by surprise. But it's true. And here's how we know. It says that Melchizedek, that two things happened in his interaction with Abraham. The first thing was is that Abraham paid Melchizedek a tithe. The author pointed out that all the other tribes of Abraham would pay tithes to Levi. But not in this case. In this case, Abraham and Levi, who would descend from Abraham, were paying a tithe to somebody else, Melchizedek. And that relationship right there demonstrated a superiority in Melchizedek. But greater than that is this, is it says that Melchizedek blessed Abraham. The only way that a blessing happens is when a superior blesses something that is inferior or someone that is inferior, never the reverse. So it is clear, and the author of Hebrews is pointing this out, and he will reiterate this, that Melchizedek was superior to Abraham and thus superior to Levi. The next point on your outline that we have is that Jesus is like Melchizedek. You got to remember here, the Israelites were wanting to go back to Abraham. And the way that the author of Hebrews was going to show them that that is not a good choice is by showing them the superiority of Jesus Christ over Abraham. And he does that by drawing comparisons between Jesus and Melchizedek. And here are some of the things that he says. He says this. He says that and we're going to look in verse 11. He says, my page turned, if perfection could have been attained through the Levitical priesthood, for on the basis of it the law was given to the people, why was there still need for another priest? He's talking about Jesus, to come. One in the order of Melchizedek, not in the order of Aaron. What the author is doing here is he's pointing back to a prophecy that the Jews were very well aware of. He was pointing back to the Psalms where King David said this. He said, the Lord has sworn and will not change his mind. You are a priest forever in the order of Melchizedek. King David was prophesying about the coming of another priest. And this priest would not be a priest from the Levitical fold, but rather he would be a priest in the order of Melchizedek. He was going to have some of the same characteristics of them. And I think it's kind of obvious already some of the things that Jesus had that he was like the Levites. And I'm not going to go through them verse by verse because this is a long section of Scripture, but let's think about it. Was Jesus a king of righteousness? Was he a king of peace? Absolutely. He lived a perfect, holy, blameless life. In verse 26 of this chapter, it talks about that. How he had never sinned. How when he was a priest, he did not have to first atone for his own sins, but he could atone directly for the people because he was perfect and blameless. He was, in other words, righteous. He was a king of righteousness. Was he a king of peace? He was a prince of peace, right? He was the king of Jerusalem. He's going to reign in Jerusalem someday, which is the ancient city of peace, the city of Salem. And here's two other quick characteristics. Remember how Melchizedek received his priesthood? It's because he was called a priest by God. He didn't receive it because he came through the Levitical line, right? He was before all of that. In the same way, Jesus did not come from the Levitical line. It says this, it says in verse 14, for it is clear that our Lord descended from Judah. And in regard to that tribe, Moses said nothing about priests. If you drop down to verse 20, it says this, it says, and it was not without an oath. Others became priests without an oath, but he became a priest with an oath when God said to him, the Lord has sworn and will not change his mind. You are a priest forever in the order of Melchizedek. Jesus was a priest not based on his lineage, just like Melchizedek. He was a priest based on oath. The last thing that's similar, let me get this off the screen. The last thing that's similar is that his priesthood was eternal. It was without end. Now, I can't give you the exact meaning of how Melchizedek's priesthood was eternal. It could mean a number of things. My personal belief is that what he was doing by saying that his priesthood was without end was he was trying to compare it to the Abrahamic covenant and the Levitical priesthood. You see, the Levitical priesthood started with the Abrahamic covenant and it ended with the new covenant. What he's pointing out by saying the Melchizedekian priesthood was without end was that it was something that was outside of that. That the Jews would not be able to put it into their line of thought that everything revolved around Abraham. However, when he's talking about Jesus and his eternal priesthood, he says, "Now there have been many of those priests since death prevented them from continuing in office. But because Jesus lives forever, he has a permanent priesthood. Therefore, he is able to save completely those who come to God through him because he always lives to intercede for them." It's very clear how Jesus' priesthood is without end. It's because Jesus is God and is eternal. And the picture that he's painting here is this, is that all other priests before Jesus, they would come for periods of time. And they would intercede on people's behalf for those periods of time. And they would make atonement for themselves once a year, and they would offer sacrifices for the people once a year. But then they would die. And another priest would have to be raised up and trained and would have to do the same exact thing. When he talks about Jesus, he paints a picture of Jesus Christ who is constantly interceding for us on our behalf. The picture I want to have in your mind, and I don't mean to any way disrespectfully anthropomorphize God, but I want you to think of what the heavenly table looks like. And you have God, and when we sin, the sense of justice inside of God is stirred up. But sitting at his right hand is Jesus Christ. And every time the justice is welled up in God, Jesus Christ takes his hand, lays it on God's face, redirects his vision to him, and says, "No, God. Remember, I already paid for that. I atoned for that. Their sins are forgiven. Look at me." And he reminds God, who doesn't need reminding, obviously, though, to look at his face and to see Jesus Christ, the Lamb of God. That's what it means to have an eternal priest who is constantly interceding. So not Jesus was like Melchizedek, but your third point on your outline is that Jesus is superior. And some of the ways that he's his superior, we've already talked about. One is the Levitical priests, without ragging on them too hard. Like, I've got nothing against them. They haven't done anything to me to hurt my feelings. But the word of God is pretty harsh. And we'll look in verse 18. It says this. It says, "The former regulation, the Levitical priesthood, is set aside because it was weak and useless." That's strong. "For the law made nothing perfect, and a better hope is introduced by which we draw near to God." In 23, he says again, "Now there have been many of those priests since death prevented them." So some of the things that he says is he says that it's weak and useless, that it made nothing perfect, and that they died, and they were unable to save completely. So he just tears apart this institution that they held so high, this institution that they kept saying, "Why can't we just go back to that? Like, wasn't that good enough?" He's saying, "No, it's not. It was weak and it was useless." And he compares it to Jesus Christ. And he says this about Jesus Christ. He says, "Such a high priest meets our need, one who is holy, blameless, pure, set apart from sinners, exalted above the heavens. Unlike the other priests, he does not need to offer sacrifices day after day, first for his own sins and then for the sins of the people. He sacrificed for their sins once for all when he offered himself. For the law appoints as high priests men who are weak, but the oath which came after the law appointed the Son who has been made perfect forever." Jesus is superior to Abraham, and that his priesthood was permanent and complete. He's in heaven today interceding on our behalf. And because he lived a holy and perfect life, he did not have to constantly reoffer sacrifices that could only cover sin. Because he was perfect, he could offer a sacrifice himself that forgave sin. So the question is this that I have for you. If Christ is so obviously superior to the Levitical system, why were they wanting to go back to the old ways under the Abrahamic covenant? Why were they wanting to turn around and make progress backwards? Here's why. Under the old way, the only thing that they had to give up was their best goat or their best sheep. Look what they have to give up when they're committed to following Jesus Christ. Then he said to them all, Jesus Christ, if anyone would come after me, he must deny himself and take up his cross daily and follow me. For whoever wants to save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for me will save it. He continues in a different sermon, not so with you. Instead, whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant, and whoever wants to be first must be your slave, just as the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. And lastly, if anyone comes to me and does not hate his father and mother, his wife and children, his brothers and sisters, yes, even his own life, he cannot be my disciple. Makes a little more sense now why the people who were new believers were having second thoughts. They recognized that their new spiritual priest had a requirement out of them that was significant. That they would be called to give up things. That they would be called to sacrifice. That if they followed in his footsteps, they could be called to die as a result of following Jesus Christ. The author of Hebrews reminded them, despite all of that, Jesus is so far superior. And as he said throughout the book, is that it's not about this life that we live, but it's about what the future holds, our heavenly kingdom. You see, just as the patriots, not the cheaters, but the patriots of the revolution, just as they recognized that it wasn't about the Revolutionary War, it wasn't about taxes, it wasn't about those things, it was about the hope that America brought to the world. It was about freedom. Just as they recognize that, he's calling the Hebrews 2,000 years before, you need to recognize that your hope in Jesus Christ is not about this short existence, but it's about your heavenly home. And he called them to live for that. And he's reminding them here that Jesus is better. He's better than Abraham. The promise that you have from Christ is better than the promise of the Abrahamic covenant. So how does this relate to you? You're not fighting a revolutionary war, and you're not really having an urge to go kill a goat and sacrifice it. But I would bet that there are many of you in here who have default behaviors. Who have behaviors that when you recognize the significance and the challenge that it could be to fully follow Christ, that you have certain behaviors that you want to just go back to. Or that maybe you want to hide behind a little bit. I can think of three areas. One of those is time. When we think about what it takes to follow Christ, when you think about what it means to be a committed follower, you recognize that it takes time. It takes time investing in people. It takes time serving in his church. It takes time raising your children in the right way rather than just giving into what they want but saying no to them. It takes time. And we can default to, though, well, isn't my life, you know, where I have a little bit of margin and a little bit of just, you know, time to watch football and do all these other things. Isn't that just enough? Like, God can't really want more than that. And that builds and that builds and that builds until, you know what, we're not even wanting to come to church anymore. Because isn't the internet just streaming it good enough? Or can I just listen to a podcast during the week? Isn't that good enough? Jesus calls us to give up our time. The second thing is this, money. A lot of you know that one of the responsibilities I have at this church is I'm the executive pastor of administration, and church finances is one of the things I deal with. And a lot of the times, I think my tendency personally in my own life and our tendency as a whole is we want to say, you know what, God, haven't we given you enough? Look at this building we have. Look at all the things that we get to do. Like, surely, God, you want me to have money to retire on? You want me to have money to pay for my child's 6 years of undergraduate education? You want me to pay for the fraternity that's causing them to take 6 years for that undergraduate education? Like, surely you don't want to give me anything more. Recognizing what it means to follow Christ, one of the hardest things is to recognize that we may never have comfort and security like our friends and neighbors have who don't know Jesus Christ. Because we're called to invest in a heavenly kingdom, not this kingdom here. What about our values? A lot of times, our values will actually cause us to have a hard time fully following Christ. I know that there are people who, when they think about standing up for their beliefs, it's very easy in this day and age to say, you know what, God, isn't it more important that I just maintain harmony with my family? I maintain harmony with my kids. Like, I know you don't want them doing these things. I know you want them coming to church with me. I know you don't want them hanging out with those friends. I know you don't want me having to watch these television shows that are inappropriate. But come on, God, everybody's doing it. Like, why can't, like, isn't the fact that I go to church and tithe enough? Why do I have to live my life differently? The author of Hebrews says, because Jesus is better, and our hope is not here, but our hope is in heaven. That's why. It's not that these things that I've brought up are bad, right? It's okay to have time. It's okay to have money. It's okay to be friends with people who don't share the same values as you. But I also think that at some point, the world needs to see Christ followers who are more convicted and committed to Jesus Christ than what they can simply convey through their Facebook posts. They need to see Christ followers who live it out in all areas of their life, who use Jesus Christ as the example of their faith, who are serving others, who are sacrificially living, who are saying no to things that bring dishonor to God, who are recognizing that Jesus is better. Our forefathers, when they declared independence, they felt the need to issue a declaration that would go down in history, and it's the Declaration of Independence, and it was signed 239 years ago yesterday. I want you to listen to this declaration. Listen to what they said. When in the course of human events, it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with one another, and to assume among the powers of the earth the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and of nature's God entitle them, a decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires that they should declare the causes which impel them to the separation. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. I'm summarizing here, but when a long train of abuses and usurpations pursuing invariably the same object evinces a design to reduce them under absolute despotism, it is their right, no, it is their duty, to throw off such government and to provide new guards for their future security. We, therefore, the representatives of the United States of America, do pledge, with a firm reliance on the protection of divine providence, we mutually pledge to each other our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor. Aren't we glad that we had patriots in this country that were able to declare independence and commit to a better thing, a better hope? Now, we don't do that anymore, right? We don't sign declarations and post them and keep them on our walls. But I would argue that as believers, we actually make declarations all the time. We make declarations through prayer. We make declarations through conversations we have. But one of the best ways is that we make declarations through worship. At this time, I'm going to ask that our band join me on stage. And I want to share with you just how I've learned to make declarations before the Lord. Because I'm going to ask that you make a declaration before the Lord today. One of the ways that I've learned to make declarations is I actually listen to the words that are sung and try to figure out what they mean and where they come from. I don't want it to just be lip service. I want to communicate to God something special through these songs. And so earlier today, we sung the song, Christ is Enough. And in that song, Christ is Enough, we have a verse or a bridge or something, I'm not a music guy, where it says, I have decided to follow Jesus. Now, what's interesting is that part of the song comes from a hymn that was composed hundreds of years ago by a Welsh missionary who, while he was sharing the gospel in India, had the great opportunity to lead a man to the Lord. And that man went and led his family to the Lord. Well, when the village elders found out about this man becoming a believer and deserting their old way of doing things, they brought him, his family, and his wife into the village square, and they surrounded him with the people of the village. And they took his wife, and they said to him, you're not going to move forward with this. You need to come back to the old way of thinking. You need to renounce Jesus Christ right now, or we're going to take the life of your wife. He looked the men in the eyes, and he said, I have decided to follow Jesus. No turning back. They killed his wife. Then they grabbed his children. And they had his children and they said, okay, well then we're going to kill your children unless you change your mind. And he looked at them and he said, I've decided to follow Jesus. The cross is before me. The world is behind me. There is no turning back. And he declared to them that. And they took the lives of his children and then ultimately took his own life. What you need to see is that that started something in that village significant. In that village, people started to recognize that this man died for something, and whatever that something was must be pretty important. And a revolution started in that village. And if you were to look at the nation of India today, you would see that there are more Christians there than there are in the United States. And it's because a man made a declaration. So here's what I want you to do. I want you to stand up right now. We're going to sing this song. And I'm going to ask our prayer team to come forward. And as the band sings this song, I want you to make a declaration. And I want to invite you. I want to encourage you. I want to implore you to come forward and make a declaration to a member of our prayer team. Maybe there's something in your way that is holding you back from saying, I have decided to follow Jesus, no turning back. Maybe there's a stronghold in your life that you need to give over. Maybe there's a set of beliefs, a comfort even, that you need to give over to the Lord. But I want you to feel the freedom to do that here as we worship.